welcome to the Libal, the podcast of the Hasib Teis Tabakh Library at ACS Athens. Today we are hosting Ms. Natalia Tadidou.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for accepting. We are very happy to have you. So a little bit on your background. You were born and raised in Greece.
Yes, in Thessaloniki.
And you have a Bachelor of Science and an MBA in Economics and a Master of Science in Management from the London School of Economics.
Yes.
We're going to get back there because that's an environment I know very well.
Okay.
You have taught TOK here at ACS and IB Economics and Business Management since 2017.
Yes.
So the year before I came. You have been a project manager for budgeting and planning at the Athens 2004 Olympic Games in the IT department.
Yes.
And you are a partner at TechVocate, board member at ZEDA. You are an author. You write fiction. You wrote a novel, Abacos, Ena Paknidi Aplisias, that was published in 2012. You have also wrote short stories and economic commentaries.
Yes, and I used to work for the stock market as a financial analyst.
And you have completed the Athens Marathon in 2022.
Yes, and I hope that I'm going to do the same for this year.
Nice.
Yes, it's addictive.
The runner's high is...
Yes, the runner's high is so true.
So you don't get bored, apparently.
No. I don't allow myself to get...
You don't know...
systematic work against that.
Nice. This all speak of various endeavors and interests that you have, and they are all very engaging, time demanding, energy consuming. Do you manage to handle them easily? What does it take to keep all this variety put together?
Okay, the keyword I'm looking for is balance, and it's very hard
because you also have kids, you have a family.
On top of anything else, you also have a family. However, not allowing yourself to get bored is the spice of life. So it's the only thing that can intrinsically, you know, motivate you, because you do something for yourself in terms of growth. Okay. So you need, in order to give back to others, you need first to give back to yourself.
Okay, that's a beautiful idea, yes.
So if you make things, you challenge yourself a bit, and you make things that calm you, as what I say also to my students, you need to take care of three things around you: your mind, your soul, and your body. If you do this, then the spillover effect is huge.
Yeah. You know the ancient say from Juvenal, from Latin poetry, mens sana in corpore sano, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Sound a healthy mind in a healthy body. I mean, wisdom ancient of centuries, but it's universal for a reason. It's all connected.
Yes, and when you say time, because time is another dimension that as we grow old, we see its importance and we see that we deteriorate.
Yeah.
So this way is just a struggle to stay alive and young.
That's beautiful. Yeah, and it works for both body and mind because, okay, we know that physical exercise is most relevant factor in keeping your body healthy, in keeping your cells young with higher chances.
It requires what I say, requires discipline. I mean, like, who wants to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday or on a Sunday and go for a long run? Nobody. Tell me. I just tell you, it's impossible that you just.
I remember.
I will leave my warm bed.
I remember when we lived in London for 5 years. You studied at the London School of Economics, so obviously you know the city. And we were living between Vauxhall Bridge and Chelsea, so right in front of the Tate Modern. So the Thames is right there. So anytime I took the tube, I stop at Vauxhall and then I walk home, and it was a 5 minutes walk. And if it were very early in the morning, 6:30 in the morning, I would see people running yes. along the Thames. And my first reaction to that was, okay, it's either someone kidnapped their child and that's a chore they have to go through. Otherwise, I see no reason for a human being doing that. It's a joke because I honestly get very bored running, actually. I love biking. I love cycling. I can go on a 10 hours long stride cycling, but running, I always found it very boring for me. My wife loves it.
For me, that I love it, and I can't hear music. I don't listen to music because I want to hear all the noises around me. I do not isolate myself and I love running in the city, anywhere outside, not at home, not on a treadmill. What I see is that it's the best time that I can enjoy the company of myself. I organize my thoughts and it helps me meditate.
Okay, so it's a communion of body and mind.
Yes, so this is how I see that. Or maybe this is how I just see the ideal of it. Maybe, you know, it's just a construct of my mind.
No, well, you know, I'm a firm believer in what works for me might not work for you and vice versa.
Yes.
Again, when we were living in London, we lived for roughly 2 years in near Chelsea. And the first 2 years we were in Bayswater. And the park is right there. That's Kensington Gardens on one side and Hyde Park on the other. My wife would always go running in the morning in Hyde Park for 1 hour or so.
Fantastic.
Yeah, no, for her it was great. And so the routine would be that I would go with her and then I would patiently wait for 1 hour sitting on a bench at Hyde Park at the Italian Gardens reading, and she would run and say, okay, yeah, no, we can go home.
So you see this positive spillover effect to you. You were there reading.
Yeah, no.
She was there running.
I loved the environment, obviously. And, you know, last week we were in New York and we were very close to Central Park. And again, it's filled with runners, etc.
Same vibe.
So it's the same vibe, except, although I'm sorry to say I would take Central Park over Hyde Park. I'm sorry. It's just beautiful. It was one of my favorite places in New York.
It is, even though I didn't have the pleasure to run there because I was very young when I visited Central Park. Ignorant.
No, well, when we go to a new place, when we are in our teens or early 20s, it's different.
It's different, exactly.
Even if you go back to the same place, you always see a different place.
You never visit the same place twice.
Exactly. You remember Heraclitus once said, you never
touch the same person.
Exactly. So
you never meet the same person.
You know, I remember that this is a topic that we have often talked with each other, my wife and I, and with our friends, because we have traveled a lot. We have moved to several different countries, and we are always, I wouldn't say baffled, but intrigued by when we go back to places that were once our daily environment, the place where we were born, or a place where we have either worked or lived, either separately or together. And we can notice all the changes of the place, and the people who kept living there don't, obviously, because to change take time and distance to be acknowledged, to be realized. And we notice how most of the people we have known for decades pretty much have the same kind of life and the same approach, the same mindset to certain issues that they used to have. It gives you a different perspective, because I don't mean it in a judgmental or negative way. It's just the way it is. When you move in time and space, that changes the perspective you have on the world.
That changes the perspective. That's why, and if we go back in history and we just see, that's why young people always were sent to travel.
Yeah.
Always they were sent to study abroad. For wealthy families, if you go back
that was the grand tour, the staple.
Because they wanted to see and to form these perspectives and to realize, it's like you go and you put yourself as a third party in a situation when there are other people running their lives and you go there as a visitor, like at the fly on the wall, and you just watch them,
yeah,
how they interact, how they think, how they behave. And then you leave, you come back. It's like a movie playing without you there.
I remember that when we started dating, my wife and I have been together since 2011. My wife is one of the most traveled person I know, to be fair. And I remember that a few months into dating, she told me something that stuck with me for the next decade and counting, obviously. And she said that traveling is the best form of education. And back then, I didn't really process what it meant, because I had traveled extensively as well. I had lived abroad, I had worked abroad, but, you know, I was more bookish.
However, being bookish, it means that you travel too.
No,
isn't
of
a
course.
Lot of writers.
Yes, yes.
So they wrote about their travels.
I agree, yes. But you know, 20 years ago, I would have told you, well, you don't need to travel to see a place. You can read a book about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Or like Jane Austen, you can stay in your room, write about places that you have never visited.
You can, well.
And it's another way of traveling, right?
Yeah. There was a famous Italian novelist, Emilio Salgari, and he wrote mostly adventure novels. And his most famous character is Sandokan, that is this Southeastern Asian prince that fights the British Empire. He was wildly popular all through the first half of the 20th century in Italy. Every kid had read his novels. In Italy, they were as popular as Marvel movies now. Everyone knew about it. There were movies about it, cartoons later on in the 1980s as well. And he was from Northern Italy. I think he was from Turin. And he wrote about Singapore and Malaysia and India and the British Empire in Southeastern Asia, which is interesting because years later, I ended up living in Singapore and exploring the area. So for an Italian, it has some meaning being in those areas because you were...
A lot of meaning, yes.
Yeah, because you were raised reading those books. And he never left his hometown. Literally never left. He wrote over, I think, 20 novels in that area and never left his hometown. He was coming from a middle-class bourgeois family and never left his...
Don't you envy these people, how they managed to do that?
I envy the power of their imagination.
Yes,
the
creativity that they had.
Yes, exactly. On the other hand, Southeastern Asia that he wrote about in his novels were also wildly inaccurate and purely imaginative. That doesn't mean that the novels are not great. They are great.
Who cares about
but again,
this? Because this is not science.
It's not a documentary.
Okay.
I say the same anytime I discuss with either students or friends about adaptations of books into movies or TV series. I honestly don't care much about historical accuracy in a product of fiction, because that's a product of fiction. It doesn't need to be true. If I want truth, I read scholarly articles, I read a textbook.
Yes, you go and you turn it to different sources. When you want, it's something different when you want to read fiction.
Yeah, it's different.
Okay, that you're looking for.
Which is
it's an escape. You're there prepared to go for another experience.
Yeah. Yeah,
not for the fact checker.
Yes,
is it true or not?
Obviously, I'm big on fact checking. Part of my job, what I do, what I am, mm-hmm. is actually being sure that the information we provide is accurate, mm-hmm. and reliable, and proven, etc. But fiction and literature are something else. I'm looking for a good story when
for a good story, a strong one.
Exactly.
And for this, the writer needs to have the freedom.
Yes, I agree. One of the things I most strongly support is, there are two ideas. In an academic environment, you should be free to talk and discuss about any sort of topic without restrictions, without judgment, as long as we are in a civilized, courteous environment, mm-hmm. when we are open to listen to each other and discuss. There should be no restriction whatsoever to what you're discussing,
mm-hmm.
because that's what the healthiest side of academia is, that you can research, you can discuss, you can confront, you can face different issues, and you can compare all possible opinions and positions without fear of repercussions, which is if we think on the global scale nowadays. But we're not dwelling into that because it's too big a discussion. On the other hand, a novelist, let's say a fiction, a creative writer, should be let free to write about whatever they want in whatever way they want. I might not agree with the ideas that are conveyed in a book. I might not agree with the personal ideas of the author, and I still can find a story beautiful and well written. To each their own.
And then it's your choice whether you want to continue reading that, go back to see another piece of work of the same writer, the same novelist.
You know, there are certain authors that I acknowledge that they are great authors. They write beautifully, and I can't stand their books.
So true.
I can't stand Agatha Christie. Generally speaking, I find mystery fictions, mystery novels very boring. They don't do for me.
The whodunit thing you don't like.
I honestly don't see the point. But I can still see, okay, they are great books. Characters are well written. There are round, multifaceted characters. They offer insight, perspectives, etc. It's just the whodunit book. I really don't see what's the point. And Agatha Christie, can't stand her books, find them insanely boring. Is she a great writer? Yes, of course. She's one of the greatest in her field and she mastered the craft. I just don't like her. I just don't like her. No, I like her, poor thing. I just don't like her writing her novels. There are countless examples. And you would know because you are a teacher, you are an economist, and you are a fiction writer as well. You have different perspectives.
It's just the part of that. I'm getting bored easily, so I try not to get bored.
That's interesting because, for example, in Italy, there is this very popular medievalist. He's a historian. He teaches in a university in northern Italy. And his name is Alessandro Barbero. You talk to anyone in Italy, everyone will know who this guy is. It's like Bill Nye, the science guy. His books are translated into English as well. Think of Bill Nye, the science guy. Yeah, someone like that. He's as popular as him. Everyone will know who he is. He's a historian specializing in military history and medieval history. And he also wrote several best-selling novels. And for 30 years now, he has been publishing both scholarly work and novels. Culture star in Italy. And during several interviews, he was asked, okay, how do you combine the scholarly academic side of your interest and being an author of fiction? And he said, well, basically, because I get bored easily and I want to do different things. Yeah. So to keep things interesting, I need to do different things. Otherwise, I get bored. He also said, I prefer writing scholarly academic work over fiction because to him it's easier.
It's easier. Yeah. Yes. Even though you get bored easily, when you try to do new endeavors, there is a point that you know nothing.
Yeah.
And you need to start from scratch.
It's terrible.
Well, you feel like you are accomplished on something else. And then you just say, it's a big deterrent to say, what am I doing now? Why am I doing this to myself? But this is what makes you, alive. You learn more about yourself, about your limits, your limitations, about how inventive you can be in the ways that you can find to make shortcuts.
That's a good way to say it,
Yes, how inventive you're going to be to try to make your life easier on this new thing again.
Yeah. Just now, when you said, okay, what I'm going to do now, what I'm going to write now, that's why I agree with you and with Professor Barbero. When you write academic work, it's at least for me, for other people might disagree, obviously. I find it easier because you don't need to invent stuff. It's there. It's more structured.
The problem with the fiction is that while you feel like you need to have no structure, indeed, you need structure.
Yeah, that's a common
And you resource. Need a map to exist, very detailed one, from which you feel so safe that you can deviate from that. If you don't have this island of safety, which is the structure, you cannot be free.
You're going to
be chaotic.
I haven't either talked to or read about authors very prolific authors that do not work with a very specific routine, with a very tight structure, and then they can allow themselves to deviate, etc. I remember, okay, I'm mentioning two names. One is very famous, one only famous in Italy, and Greece somehow, because his books are adapted into movies that are available in Greek too. One is Stephen King, and the other one is Andrea Camilleri. And both Camilleri and Stephen King, when they were talking about the how they write, and then very prolific authors, both of them, the ability of writing of Stephen King is legendary. He can, at a certain point, he could release a book every 6 months, like 600 pages long book. And they were asked, how can you can do it? Well, very simple. I wake up at this time every day. I write for this many hours every single day. I try to write 2,000 words every single day. And at the end of the day, I must have completed this many pages. Doesn't matter whether they are good, bad, etc. I will get back to it, but this is what I'm going to do.
This is the thing. It requires, again, discipline.
Yeah.
And if you just want to see a common denominator to that,
yeah,
you see discipline,
yeah,
you see effort, and you do not waste
consistency.
Consistency.
Because it takes a lot of energy to be that.
Yes. And you don't see, some people think that innovation will come out of the blue while you're sitting on your own at a house and looking at the sea and just thinking. No.
Yeah, it's inspiration without dedication means nothing.
It's nothing.
You need to
combine. It's nothing. And you can be very well inspired and four walls with no window.
Yeah, I agree. Probably that's one of the reasons for I wouldn't be able to write fiction, because I'm not that a disciplined person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do well with structures. And I'm writing academic work, for example. I publish it.
You just said before, this is easy stuff.
Yeah, but you see, I believe it all depends on how you work, what you do, and what you find interesting. I publish a chapter in a book in 2024, and I'm publishing another paper soon. I think it's going to come out in a few months. And I'm currently working on publishing a book about artificial intelligence and fake news. And it's probably going to be with Springer. But the point is that it's very academic and very sectorial. And sometimes I write endlessly, relentlessly for like 2 days, for 3 days over the weekend, and then I don't touch the thing for 10 days. And after 2 weeks, I go back and I rewrite and extend. You can't do that with fiction. In my mind, you need to have a specific structure.
You need, though, breaks, because you need to have some distance of what you wrote. So you're more objective about what you see. So you revisit, you rewrite, you just say, I don't like this.
Oh.
So this goes to
question. I'm sorry, since you mentioned, did you, after it was published, for example, your last novel was 2012. You published it, yes. Did you read it after it was published?
Yes.
Yes. Did you like it?
Okay, pause. Writing never ends.
Okay.
We know this. We just,
yeah, we do.
Sometime we just need to decide to just put a full stop.
Okay.
And say, that's it. You wrote something and you reread that. You actually don't like it because you find other ways.
I could have said it better. I could have written this in a different, more compelling way. Yeah, yeah, I agree.
That's why I did that the first or the second month after it was published.
Okay.
I had to read that again to just see if everything is in place. I found some mistakes and I just said, oh my gosh, why? But then, no.
No.
No, not again.
Not again. Okay.
No, I didn't want to do this to myself.
The first thing I ever published was a paper I wrote when I was a freshman in college. So I was very young. I was turning 20. And my professor back then invited me to give a lecture during his course. And then he really liked the lecture. So he helped me get the paper published in an academic journal, which was a big deal because, again, I wasn't even graduated from college. I was 20, so I was very excited. And I happened to have reread it some time ago, some months ago. I honestly think it's way better than anything I have written in recent times, honestly. And again, it was in a completely different field. It was about Italian literature specifically. So I found it way more interesting and better written than what I have written recently. Now, what I've written recently, for example, is more refined, is more academic, obviously, because we're talking about 20 years.
However it might lack.
Yeah, but the other one had a kind of freshness and passion that somehow I think, yeah, okay, it's not there in the things. It was also written in a different language because it was written in Italian. Now, obviously, I write in English. But then I said, yeah, okay, I was writing well, actually. Talking about your different interests, because this intrigues me and is one of the reasons I really wanted to have you here. Here at ACS, you taught theory of knowledge, which is probably the favorite course of mine that we have here at ACS.
For me too.
Yeah, you go. It's a common opinion. Anyone who teaches TOK or has taught several subjects among them, everyone always says, no, TOK is
it's the favorite. Only way that you can see knowledge
as
one common thing across disciplines.
Yes, and that's the interesting part. Because
that's the interesting part. It's a revelation for young minds, for the students, when they see this perspective and see how physics can be related to art.
Yeah.
And how math can be part of social sciences.
Yeah.
Or music. Literature.
Yeah.
Or music. And if they see this, it's a whole new world.
I think it's because we as human beings, we have the tendency of thinking of certain issues, certain topics, certain situations, not in a historical or critical way. We tend to think that if something is as we see it now, it's always been like this, unless, of course, we have studied, we are taught, we are trained to think and analyze in a certain way. And that's why probably school is actually very important. But if we see a certain issue, a certain topic that we are witnessing it in a certain way now, okay, it has been like this forever. We don't think that maybe perspectives have changed in how we approach certain things. And it's no one's fault. It's a systemic requirement. We think, at least in school, as students, not as teachers, because hopefully we have a wider, deeper perspective than students. As a students, we see, okay, we have literature, language and literature. We have either history or social studies, and then we have music, and then we have economics, and then we have math, and we have chemistry, and it's chemistry, it's math, it's music, it's art, and they are all separate in their own way, all important in their own way, but they are like boxes that I go to this class and then I go to this class and I study them individually.
It is when you mature as a learner, when you understand the interconnectedness of the disciplines.
Yeah, because everything is basically one big thing and there are several ways to approach it. I used to say knowledge and reality, you cannot interpret or understand them with only one approach. It's too complex.
It's multidimensional.
Yes, exactly.
It's too complex. It's never static.
Yeah. Everything
changes. It's so dynamic. And you also change.
Yeah, obviously.
You're part of this. It's much bigger than we think.
Yeah. I remember that I was talking to a student some time ago. And I said, I don't want to study math and economics. Okay, why not? Because I'm going to study, art. I'm going to art school after graduating. Okay. And I said, no, you should actually be mindful of this. I said, and not because it's in the program, not because it's in the syllabus, because again, if you were living, for example, in Italy in the 1930s, what you were taught in your syllabus was highly questionable. The thing is, you need to study this because it's in the syllabus. I don't think it's a good argument. I don't think it's a good point. The syllabi can be altered, can be changed, can be discussed. The importance of knowledge cannot. It's a universal value. And I remember that the student asked me, okay, but why did you study literature and history instead of economics? Because that's the things that I find more interesting from my point of view. That is what speaks more to to me, that doesn't mean that it needs to be the only one. I need people who do economics and math, and they all matter, just that it doesn't work for my own interest, but doesn't mean I don't find them relevant or interesting or necessary. It's just a different kind of approaching. It makes sense. Again, what works for me might not work for you.
It makes sense, and that's why we also say the interdisciplinary mm-hmm. approach that we see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And TOK is a perfect example.
Exactly. And it's very important that the students are exposed to this mm-hmm. perspective, the yeah. TOK, the theory of knowledge, at an age before they enter college.
Yeah.
At an age that are very more pure.
Yes, more receptive.
More receptive.
Yeah, less biased.
Have seen less.
Yes, they have seen
They are
less.
Closer to the tabula rasa.
Yeah, I agree. It's
for the learner later, it helps them more to be more open.
Yeah, makes sense, actually, because, again, it goes to the very core of the issue. I mean, theory of knowledge poses the questions, how do I know something?
And it's when you go and you teach economics, right,
yes.
to mm-hmm. the students, and you see the TOK perspective of this.
Mm-hmm.
For example, economics, which is a dismal science, we study about how we can satisfy our unlimited needs and wants mm-hmm. with limited resources. You understand that
okay.
when you try to solve this problem, it's dark. You know
yeah.
that it's not possible. It's an equation that will never be solved.
Yeah.
So when you see the TOK perspective of this,
mm-hmm.
and you see the different stakeholders,
mm-hmm.
you see how the government organizations, you know, institutions that they need to step up, and you see the limitations of all the institutions we have, and you see the TOK perspective and how this all started and the limitations that we see that manifest themselves in the decisions that we see in global issues and economic issues, they have root there.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah.
And this is interesting.
I mean, this opens for a reflection that I've been thinking about for quite some time, because again, you have taught TOK and you have taught economics and business management. And what I notice amongst an expression I hate, but I need to use it, the
okay.
general public, okay?
Okay?
I can see that there is a serious lack of economic education. There are certain things that are universally taught, like math, or language, or literature.
Yes, and there is a bias, I would say, in how we construct the curriculum
yeah.
and what the students are taught. Even for economics, if you do not choose IB economics,
mm-hmm.
you leave school, you're 18 years old,
mm-hmm.
and you don't understand basic stuff, like, let's say, what necessitates taxes, and why I need to pay taxes? What does it mean if
I had this conversation with 40-year-olds? I don't understand why I need to pay taxes.
Yes, they don't understand. Or what is an interest rate? What is the cost of money?
Okay,
and
no, that is already.
They don't understand this. They don't understand the impact of inflation. And if I'm in the classroom and I just say, "Inflation, guys, inflation started world wars."
Yeah,
inflation is so powerful that can change governments. Okay,
it has.
It has.
Yes, historically.
And
yes.
You have worse things than that. You have unemployment. And why it's a right for everyone to work? Why in constitutions, countries around the world, nations, they write that it's a right to work? Why? And things that are very important that need to be also seen through the perspective of economics and not just history literature.
Yep.
So you need to see that through economics.
Think of the impact it had on the United States, FDR's New Deal in 1920s and 1930s. That the idea that we have this massive amount of unemployed people and we need to give them jobs for several reasons, not just because like that they generate an income, etc., but it impacts on people psychology, people esteem.
And also the future.
And the future, obviously.
Because if you're unemployed, you cannot
yeah.
plan your life.
Yeah.
You cannot create the future generation. You cannot create the future if you're unemployed.
I remember about what you mentioned now about the lack of understanding of basic economic concepts, how inflation impacts not just the government, but daily life, everyone's life, or why the cost of money is an important concept to be understood.
And we also need to understand the time lags. All this stuff that you see, that I see an improvement in my living standards or a deterioration of it, but I don't understand it at the very moment that this occurs. Well, I see that later, months later, maybe years later. However, the way that I feel has an impact on my choices, has an impact of what my thinking, okay, my decisions. So if I'm more aware of what goes on out there, what happens and what I see, or when I see, I'm more informed decision maker.
But that's the key part. You need.
And that's the key part, because economy is us. And what it's going to be, the major decisions, what society wants, we are society.
Yeah.
But if we are unclear about what we want, or maybe uncertain, or maybe we enter a transaction, okay, with fundamental issues that makes us, you know, disadvantaged.
You know, I don't think I can nitpick a single historical event, historical phenomenon that doesn't have an economic foundation at its core.
Of course, everything is economics. And politics is economics. Exactly.
You don't need to have a Marxist foundation to understand that economics is one of the engines of the world. Whatever historical period you think of, there's always an economic side to it. I remember that there was a Renaissance military leader from Italy. He actually wrote a treatise about war in the 16th century. And in this book, he wrote, you need three things to lead a war. The first thing is money. The second thing is money. The third thing is money. It's without that, you can't pay your soldiers. You can't buy equipment. You can't buy weapons. You can't buy supplies. You can't buy horses
and stuff. Reflects value.
Yeah.
The value that we assign, that money can buy.
Yeah, it's there is no escape there.
So everything is about value.
Yeah.
Everything is about values.
Yeah.
And everything is a value added.
Yeah.
So going back to what we said in the beginning, this is how we keep our life interesting.
Yeah, I like that. You know, years ago, I was teaching history in Italy. And I was talking about the birth of the bank system in roughly in Italy in around the early 14th century, you know, with the banks in Florence and Siena. And I remember that I had a kid. Her mom had a business, actually. After school, we were talking. She said, yeah, I'm going to open my business too when I graduate. Okay, and how are you going to do that? Well, I'm going to do the same business as my mom does. Okay, and how are you going to do that? Did you train for that? No. Okay, do you have a capital to start a business? Because if it's not you, you need to employ people. No. Okay, and how do you imagine to start your business? I will ask money. To whom? Well, to my mom. What if she doesn't want to give it to you? I'll ask the bank. Okay, do you know how you get a loan from a bank? I go and I ask for the money. Yeah, they don't give it to you like that, you know. So
it's a rule. I mean, like, banks never give money to those that they mostly need them.
And you see, but that's the thing. It's a very basic concept. There are people, and I'm not trying to be too generalistic here, but it's a reality. Most of the general public doesn't really know how basic, important concepts in economics work. And why? And
if economics is one of the major reasons that you decide to whether to vote for one government or the other.
Yeah.
So this means that you are not able to make a right decision.
Yeah, I agree. You pointed to two main elements to me. You need to keep things interesting and you need to make informed choices.
Yeah.
It all goes to those two elements. Okay, Natalia, thank you for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
My pleasure. I'm very happy we had this conversation.
I think we had
We had fun. Yeah, we kept the things interesting. Thank you, Mr. Dido.
Thank you.
And this was the Liebe Hall. Thanks again for Miss Natalia de Dido. And we'll have you the next time. Thank you for listening.